I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Henry Block's name is all over Kansas City in a very literal sense, from UMKC and the Nelson Atkins Museum to the shining glass high-rise downtown where his tax prep company is headquartered. His impact on this city is undeniable. So it was truly a loss yesterday when Henry Block died at 96. Today we'll hear from institutional leaders to get a deeper sense of the imprint he left on our community. Then, most fourth graders in Kansas can't read at grade level. It's a problem that's tied to their high school graduation rates and whether or not they spend time in jail. Fortunately, there are people working to improve those numbers, and we'll find out what role parents can play. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Kansas City today is mourning the passing of Henry Block, who died Tuesday morning at age 96. Not only did Henry launch an amazingly successful business, H&R Block, but he was a titan in the philanthropic community, reshaping the Nelson Atkins Museum of Art with his iconic Block building, donating nearly priceless impressionist pieces to the museum, establishing the Block School of Management at UMKC, and creating the Marion Block Neuroscience Institute over at St. Luke's. He was, in every sense of the word, a foundational member of this community. Today, a look back at Henry Block's philanthropic legacy that will endure for generations. With us to begin our remembrance is Julian Zugasa-Goitia. He's director of the Nelson Atkins. Julian, it's always great to have you here.
An honor to be here today.
You know, Henry Block's contributions to the Nelson Atkins are no less than staggering. Didn't he always refer to the art that he had donated as his pretty pictures? I just love that.
Indeed. And I think that is something that was always so beautiful in relating to him. And he had a very down-to-earth relationship to these works of art. In no means he would consider himself an expert in his own collection. He always sought the advice of others. But in doing so, he created a community around it. And so first it was with Ted Koe, and then Mark Wilson, my two predecessors, in building that relationship. But it was always that intimacy and that casualness. And I think in that sense, he has a lot to inspire about just enjoying those pictures that way.
I was going to say he enjoyed the pictures, but you've pointed out he was really into the frames too, frames around the pictures.
He was. There's a lot of anecdotes that we discussed on that. But when we were bringing the collection into the museum, and with his accord and pleasure. And the way we managed to do it is by giving him some replicas so that his walls would not be bare. And he enjoyed the replicas even more because he said, oh, I don't have to insure them. Also, there could be light. But when we were doing that, he said, but give me the replicas, but let me keep my original frames as long as I can. And he did.
He was into the frames.
Totally.
He had this commitment to the mind, the body, and the soul. That was sort of his governing philosophy. Do you know where that came from in his life?
No, I cannot. But it tells you also what a committed philanthropist he was, in which he was really impacting the three areas in which cities thrive, you know, education through the core and through his involvement with UMKC, health through his involvement with St. Luke's Hospital, and then the spirit with the Nelson as his major philanthropies.
He clearly was very deliberate about it.
I think it is very, very deliberate in everything he did, yes.
Do you know what drove his commitment to the arts in particular?
Well, I think the arts did come from his personal enjoyment. Early on in his life, he was starting to collect, and again, in a simple way. And he told the story that his first thing, he was in a trip in the Netherlands, and he buys a work of art that he thinks is an old master's, ships it, asks to be shipped to the Nelson Atkins. He was already involved with the institution. And the then director, and I think it might be even before Ted Koe, I think, says, well, you know, you bought something, but this is not what it is proposed to be. It is not a great old master. I think maybe something worked. So he learned from a bad experience of buying on impulse, perhaps, something that he thought was good and it was not what it was proved to be. So he said, like, well, what should I then collect. And so he started a long-term relationship with TEBCO buying Impressionist art, but he derived a great pleasure on that. But what I think from my experience with him, what he derived more pleasure is seeing how the museum becomes a place where people can enjoy the things.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why the public nature of the museum was always in his mind, very deliberately, what he was collecting, with the advice of my predecessors, was to complement what we already have.
Yeah.
And that's why also when he gives us finally his collection, he says, they're going to be happy with their sisters. And that's the way he was portraying this. It is that his collection really meshes up and complements what we already have because he was deliberate. So he always thought of this becoming a public good. And I think he saw in the museum a place where others who had not the fortune to have a private collection could enjoy things. And he himself, I think, early on in his life, enjoyed those things through the museum.
You know, I was really struck when he gave the money for the block building, the addition to the Nelson Atkins. This was a pretty modernist structure. Stephen Hull was the architect of it. It contrasts pretty sharply with the original Nelson Atkins Museum, and it was kind of a gamble. And I'm wondering to what extent that unnerved him or he hung with the vision once it was unveiled.
So the naming of the building after the blocks comes from their commitment to give the collection. And the leaders behind the vision of this new expansion and supporting the vision of Stephen Hall was definitely the board at the time. And so I would highlight and signal also that I think the board chair at the time was Mr. Don Hall. There was the Sauslands were very involved also in raising the funds, as was Henry Block. So I think when there were some controversies around, they stuck together in the vision that they had all really supported from the onset.
But how often did he come up to view his paintings that he had donated to the museum and to sort of saunter through that part of the museum?
So the Block building, when it was open, had as a special exhibition his collection. So that was featured for the first time like 10 years ago or 12 years ago. But what happened then is when he gave us a collection, he knew that given how we organize our collections and that they would merge with the already existing collections, that we had to renovate the galleries in the old or the classic building, the Nelson building. And there is when all those conversations, and he was super engaged from the get-go, looking at the details. Oh, first, at the beginning, with a good question, it's like, because he was also generous and philanthropic in supporting the renovation, but it's like, why do you need so much money? Could just buying 39 new nails do it? You know, it's like, I'm giving you some paintings, just put it in between the other paintings. So once we explain why we wanted to bring up to quality the good lighting that we have, today, I think those galleries are the most sophisticated, most up-to-date in Kansas City, but also in the nation. And so he started enjoying the process once he understood. We took the whole building down to the studs, and then he would come every other week to look at that. One of the most beautiful moments, one of his closest friends is Mr. Dunn, of Jay Dunn, and Jay Dunn was doing the construction for us. So seeing two great friends in their 90s come and see the construction often, they signed the walls at one point. Hmm. I remember also coming from some vacations, and he says, Julian, I haven't seen you in a couple of weeks. Where have you been? I'm like, hey, Henry, I was taking some vacation. it's still allowed. And he says, oh, you were away. Let me show you how much progress we've done.
No
you
kidding.
Know, it is, he was doing progress.
He was really
noticing the details. So that was such an amazing experience.
Yeah.
And the joy also then to complete it, that he could see it in his lifetime, and that he got from a lot of people he knew, but people he never knew, anonymous people, who would write him a letter, who would send him a regards, saying how much that collection impacted them. That was a very moving thing to see.
That's Julian Zugasa-Goitia, the director of the Nelson Atkins Museum of Art, remembering Henry Block's contributions to the museum. Julian, always great to have you here. Thanks so much.
Always an honor.
Well, part of Henry Block's legacy centers on the school that bears his name. That's the Henry W. Block School of Management on the UMKC campus. Here to talk about this part of Henry Block's life is Brian Kloss. He's dean of UMKC's Henry W. Block School of Management. Dean, nice to have you here. Welcome.
My privilege to be here.
Henry Block once studied at UMKC, and he had a natural affinity for the school. Is that what led him to endow the former UMKC UMKC School of Business back in 1986?
Well, certainly that is part of it, but I don't know if it's the dominant reason. I think if you look at Henry, he had a love for this community, for Kansas City, and he recognized that he could help Kansas City by helping to build an institution where we were training talent, producing entrepreneurs, producing nonprofit leaders. So I think it was all about using the Block School and his contribution to the Block School to help Kansas City.
What was his vision for the school, Brian?
I think for Henry, he was looking for us to produce world-class programs that would be well-positioned to, again, help Kansas City in its development. He wanted us to have faculty that were world-class, programs that would be available to students from all walks of life. He wanted us to have faculty that would be positioned to train executives from leading organizations, and he wanted us to have programs that would be available to help students launch their career from whatever background they might have.
And so the focus is what? The academic focus? Entrepreneurship? What are we looking at?
I think Henry wanted us to be positioned to serve Kansas City across a number of areas.
Okay.
Entrepreneurship was incredibly important to Henry. Innovation was incredibly important to him. But he also wanted us to be able to ensure that we were training students to go into nonprofit organizations, to learn to give back. He wanted individuals to be able to go into the financial community and serve there as well. So he wanted a broad-based, world-class institution that had some areas of true excellence.
He created the Henry W. Block Executive Hall for Entrepreneurship and Innovation back in 2013. Describe the hall to us for folks who haven't been over there.
When you walk in, you immediately get a sense that this is a place where important things happen.
Mm-hmm.
So you walk in and you see an atrium, open atrium. You see three floors of classrooms and office space. And when you're looking up, you see energy, you see activity, and you walk by classrooms that are glassed in, and you see students engaged in project work and case discussions. You see entrepreneurs coming in to meet with their mentor in the eScholars program. You walk by the finance lab where students are using the Bloomberg terminals to make investment decisions. So you just see an incredible hub of activity and energy that I think changes sort of the mindset of those who are using the facility.
And sometimes when people walk through that building, they would sometimes see Henry Block himself.
Indeed. Henry was a frequent visitor to our campus, and when he was there, he was fully there. He was engaged. I remember one time walking into Executive Hall, and in the atrium, Henry is sitting down, and in front of him were 25 or 30 students.
Okay.
And these students happened to be participants in the Block Scholars Program, which is a program that was designed and funded by Henry to help make college affordable to those from underserved communities. And Henry was just sitting down, chatting with these students, asking them, what are your career goals? What are your challenges that you're facing? Letting them ask him questions, giving them advice. And you could tell that here, these students were sitting there and they were thinking to themselves, I'm sitting here as an 18-year-old, a 19-year-old, getting advice from Henry Block, and he's giving it to me in the most humble and the most kind way possible.
You just took the word out of my mouth. I was going to say, when he did that, knowing him just a little bit, he would not be bragging about his accomplishments. This was a man who was pretty low-key about what he had pulled off.
Absolutely. In fact, it was the complete reverse of this.
Yes.
I remember he would say things to students like this. I was not a great student, and I think that's probably not true, but he would say, I was not a great student, but what I did is I worked hard, and I urge you to work hard. And so he was delivering a message with great humility that I think impacted the students, and it allowed them to sort of see you can achieve great things and be a wonderful human being at the same time. And that's an incredible inspiration for our students and for the campus.
You know, I love this quote that he gave at the 2013 graduation ceremony. He said this, Brian, as a retired CEO, I can tell you the view from the top is pleasant and satisfying, but the never-to-be-forgotten excitement, the fun, and the challenge is in the climb.
Absolutely, and he never gave up on that view because his engagement with us was all about the climb.
Yeah.
It was about working with us, helping us to make the climb to better serve Kansas City.
And he talked often, he talked on this show any number of times about how lucky he was in his journey. I mean, he worked hard, did a lot of things right, but he said he got lucky.
And that was a message that he also communicated with the students. It was about take advantage of the opportunities you have, and show gratitude.
That's Brian Kloss. He's Dean of the UMKC Henry W. Block School of Management. Brian, thanks for your time.
Thank you, Steve. I appreciate it.
One aspect of Henry Block's life often lost in all the focus on H&R Block and his charitable work was his service in World War II. Shortly after the attack on Pearl Harbor, Henry Block enlisted in the Army Air Corps and was trained as a navigator for bomber missions. He flew 32 missions over Europe as a navigator on the B-17 Flying Fortress. His first mission, in fact, was the third ever raid over Berlin by the Allies. John Herron, an associate dean and professor at UMKC, is one of the authors of Navigating a Life, Henry Block and World War II, and he joins us now. John, it's nice to have you.
Good morning, Steve.
Henry Block flew, as I said, in the B-17. This was America's workhorse airplane, dropping more bombs than any other U.S. aircraft during World War II. It was also a pretty sturdy aircraft. Tell us about it.
So it was sturdy in one sense. It was sturdy in that it was durable. It could take a beating. But as Henry told me many times in our conversations, it was also the B-17 has a very thin skin. I mean, it's just an aluminum shelled aircraft. So he could feel the elements. He could feel, you know, the vibrations in the aircraft when he took shrapnel. You could smell it, he would say. So it was an incredibly powerful aircraft, but at the same time, it had that same fragility that would define any, you know, vessel that was involved in war.
What was his job aboard that aircraft?
So he trained actually to be a pilot. So he passed in basic service. He excelled at the physical test. He excelled at the mental tests. He was selected to be a pilot. And right before he was sent to pilot school, his mother intervened and let him know that she thought that was too dangerous an occupation for him. She insisted that
moms could do that.
Yeah, right. That if he didn't get a less dangerous position, that his father was going to go to Washington, D.C. and get him out of the Army. It's doubtful that would have happened. But the dutiful son, Henry appeased his parents, especially his mother, by agreeing to become a navigator. And his mother believed that that was, in fact, a less dangerous position in the aircraft. But so he was...
Was it?
Well, of course not. He was... The pilots were up front. He was
right
behind their compartment. But to his mother, that was seemed to be less dangerous. The job of the navigator is exactly what we've all seen in a dozen different World War II movies.
Right.
The planes fly in a formation to the target. Once they get close to the target, they then have to protocols go into place. The navigator then steps up his navigation of the aircraft to reach the target. And then most of those planes are no longer in formation when they're trying to get back to base. That's when Henry said he earned his living, is a plane that is damaged by shrapnel or low on fuel. It was his job to get that aircraft safely back to base. So he had to know the train of every day's mission. He had to know all the compass points. He had to know all the data that was associated with the aircraft. But again, he felt great responsibility to get himself and his crew from their early morning liftoff back home safely every single day.
He flew these 32 missions, John. How much in danger was he as he flew some of those missions?
So he was in danger, probably in grave danger in 85% of those missions.
Wow.
And he will tell you it wasn't 32 missions. He believes he didn't get credit for two missions. So he flew three missions on D-Day, for which the Army credited him with one. So it's a point of conflict for him always. The navigator, the pilots obviously have a sight out to what's happening. The navigator also has a great big window on their right side. So he could see every single mission, the bombers in formation, taking hits and going down. He's over the North Atlantic, and the plane next to his is shot down, and he watches the parachutes pop, and he knows that those men are dead men because there's no way they're going to be rescued in time. So he was often in very dangerous situations.
He did say, though, that when he flew on D-Day, that was one of the days when he did not take on any shrapnel.
Yeah, so he flew an early morning, a late morning, and an early afternoon mission, and his plane was unharmed in all three missions.
And what was his job that day? Do you remember?
Same thing, still being navigator, still helping. That's a relatively short hop. from Eastern England over the channel. So that's why they could do so many missions. But his job never changed. He was always going to be a navigator on this crew.
Did he talk about being scared?
He talked a lot about being scared. Matter of fact, he looks back at the first part of his military career with some, not regret exactly, but that he was, at times he thought he was so scared he wasn't able to function properly. He wasn't able to do his duty as well as he could. About halfway through his tour, we had this very moving conversation where he talked about becoming a fatalist, and not in a desperate kind of way, but in a accepting of whatever fate was going to be delivered to him. And when he stopped worrying about whether or not he was going to make it home and just started focusing on the mission, he said he became a much better soldier. And it were that ability to bring some of those lessons that he brought back into his business career as well. But he will say, I'm a fatalist and not a pessimist. I need to emphasize that because he always was very optimistic. But his devotion to duty was above all else.
He knew he was a lucky man to have survived all that.
Very lucky. He would say that, and Brian just mentioned that. He said he was lucky in many, many ways. And there is, at his Air Force base, it's Horam in Eastern England, once you completed the required missions, there is a party thrown for you. You are inaugurated into the Lucky Bastards Club, which is those who have finished their missions or are on their way home. So he always believed that he had gotten lucky because he knew that there were, you know, many men that did not have that luxury coming home.
Did he talk about what it was like to receive shrapnel, to be hit with by the enemy and what that's like to be that high in the sky and be in that kind of danger?
He talked about this, what it was like to his senses. So like he, there was a time where he's behind the pilots, right just slightly in between them is the bombardier, the person who's in charge of dropping the payload. They were on a particularly brutal mission. He got up from his navigator compartment to check on the bombardier as they're about ready to release their payload. He walks back to his compartment. He'd been gone just a few seconds, and the entire navigator seat was blown out of the aircraft. So just this serendipity that he happened to stand up at that particular moment. He talked about what it was like to watch these other planes going down and what it felt like. He said he'd always get a cold sweat. He talked a lot about the chills that he would when he watched these planes being shot out of the sky, when he watched the flak coming up from Germany. And once was kind of a crippling fear very quickly became, as I just mentioned, a quiet confidence. There's no question that he was moved by the experience. And he says time and again that without World War II, there is no H&R Block. He linked the two together in many different ways.
In what sense?
So a couple different senses. One is after he finished his tour, he was selected by the Army for this specialized training program at Harvard, brand new, called Statistical Control. It was, in essence, a advanced inventory system. And so he got this unique training in business practices. But I think more to the point was that it was this dedication to duty. It was when he first came back from the war, he was living in his parents' basement, you know, right here in Brookside, trying to make a go, starts a business with his brother, his older brother. It basically flops. His older brother decides, you know, I've had enough. I'm going to leave the company.
Right.
We had the very moving conversation one time where he said, I had seen worse. So he and his brother are basically walking up and down Troost Avenue, knocking on doors, trying to drum up business. And they're getting lots of polite and sometimes not so polite rejections. To him, that was nothing. Right?
Mm-hmm.
I'd been through worse.
That's
I'm not
great
quitting.
Story.
And so he's like, I am not quitting. And if that means I work a little harder, if that means a few extra months in my parents' basement before we figure out what we're doing, that's fine. But for him, war was the training. He loved the routine. Again, he writes back from basic training about he loved everything. He loved the exercises, the hiking at 2 o'clock in the morning, the yelling of the drill instructors. He thought it was all just great.
Wow.
And he excelled at it. So he loved the routine. He loved the structure. He loved the camaraderie. He loved the duty. But above all else, he loved the devotion, the hard work ethic, which is in part what his family has talked about. But also it comes from an Army ethic as well.
That's John Herron. He's an associate dean in the College of Arts and Sciences at UMKC. John, thank you very much for your remembrance of Henry Block as well. Time for a break here. When we come back, we'll talk about fourth grade reading in Kansas and the state of crisis that it's in. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we are back. I'm Steve Kraske. Segregation is often viewed as a thing of the past, but local high schoolers are getting a lesson on how it still impacts them. Yesterday on the program, we heard about the segregation bus tour of Kansas City. You can listen to that conversation at kcur.org/uptodate. And tomorrow, in the early days of Kansas City, the stockyards created wealth for owners and jobs for thousands of multi-ethnic workers who propelled the city into the modern age. We'll learn more about that tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, when it comes to fourth graders, there's a trend in Kansas. Almost two of every three fourth graders are not reading at grade level. And that's a problem. Kids who don't read at grade level are less likely to graduate high school, and they're more likely to end up in prison or even in poverty. That's what the research shows. Fortunately, there are a lot of people working to improve these numbers. We're about to meet several of them. With us, Christine Peterson is the Latino Services Outreach Librarian for the Johnson County Public Library. Christine, nice to have you. Welcome.
Thank you very much for the invitation, Steve.
Barry Zuckerman is a professor of pediatrics at the Boston University School of Medicine. Barry, it's nice to have you.
Thank you, Steve.
Chan Brown is the program officer for the Kansas Health Foundation. Chan, good morning.
Thank you for having me.
Well, Chan, how big of a problem do we have in Kansas when it comes to the number of fourth graders reading at grade level? What are we looking at here?
Well, you know, as you mentioned, 63% of Kansas fourth graders are not reading at grade level.
63%? That's going to shock a lot of people.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, research also shows that those who don't read at grade level, by the time they enter fourth grade, are four times less likely to graduate from high school. And two-thirds of them, as you said, may end up in prison or poverty.
Barry, I can't help but wonder, how does that 63% of fourth graders not reading at grade level in Kansas, how does that compare to other states across the country, just broadly speaking?
I think it's unfortunately pretty close. Massachusetts has one of the best rates, but if you disaggregate the information by either income or race, you see low-income children doing about the same thing. So I think what you see in Kansas City, I assume, is a concentration of low-income kids, which is a barrier for that kind of problem that we're seeing. And just one comment I would make, you know, up to fourth grade, children learn to read. But after that, they read to learn. And if you're still trying to figure out how to sound the letters out and how to read the sentences, you're not going to get the content in. And that's where things start falling apart.
Christine, you're with the Johnson County Public Library. How do you react when you hear about these numbers being what they are?
Well, it is very disturbing. And then you bring in the dynamic of an ELL or English language learner who's struggling with the language because at home they probably don't speak English. Mm-hmm. So now they're in an environment where they are to learn to read, and English is a difficult language to learn.
Do we have a sense, does Kansas have an unusually high population of kids who are English as a second language?
In Johnson County alone, I know that there is 8% that are immigrant and ELL. Throughout the entire state of Kansas, we'd have to check the internet.
I assume in Wyandotte that number is probably higher then.
It is indeed.
Yeah. Sean, what's happening out across our state that's causing these low numbers? I mean, I was going to say Kansas has long had a reputation as a state that values public education, but these numbers don't suggest that Kansas is still a state that's on top of its game here.
Well, in terms of, you know, what's specifically causing it, I don't know if I could address that.
Yeah.
I think there are a number of factors.
Such as?
You know, well, we know parents are often very busy, and sometimes, you know, they may be struggling with a number of things that are happening in the household. You know, so if there are issues related to poverty or, you know, getting food on the table or whatever that might be, those can kind of impact, you know, what kind of time you have available for reading.
And that can really become a paramount concern, more important than reading when you can't get food on the table. Being poor is hard work.
Right.
People forget that sometimes, I think. Well, let's be proactive here and help parents out. And Professor, how much time a day ideally should parents be reading to their kids?
Actually, I don't know if anybody put a number on it, but the thing that's important to tell parents, children have a short attention span. So 5-6 minutes of reading, you know, 4 or 5 times a day is really nice, particularly at bedtime. But the key is it's not just, you know, when I think of reading, I'm thinking of the younger children, which, you know, even before they get to school, because many of the children you're talking about enter school not ready to learn and read. And that's why, at least as pediatricians, we started, you know, giving out books to parents. And in addition to the issues of poverty, you know, there's an issue of many of our particular parents who grew up in cultures where parents didn't read to their children aren't used to doing this. So we have to encourage, you know, parents reading, because the issue is it starts well before fourth grade. It really starts at the, you know, during infancy and the kind of exposure children have to books and reading.
I get the sense, Barry, that, you know, you hear this a lot. You can't read to your kids enough. Does that generally cover it here?
Yeah, but I want to emphasize, when we talk about reading, that we're really talking about almost, particularly for young children, reading aloud is playing, is pointing, is labeling, is going backing and forth, it's telling stories, and it's reading a story. So for the youngest kids, it's true. It really is. Books are a way of having an interaction using words and enjoyment between parents and their children. So it's really more, you know, it's really a way of children of having a conversation, particularly with young children, because the kind of things we talk about with 10 and 15-year-olds, obviously we can't with young children.
Christine, talk to us about the challenge of learning how to read in households, Latino households, again, where English may not be the dominant language that's used.
And then it's not only that, Steve, because we are seeing some immigrants who come with very low levels of education, and they themselves do not even feel confident in reading. So it's not just the English. It's also, as was earlier mentioned, reading to your children from birth until they begin school is the best way to help develop those skills so a child enjoys learning to read. However, if you come from a culture where books are scarce, books are expensive, and no libraries as we see in the United States, that makes it difficult for those cultures.
So how do you help those families? How do you guide them along the path to this very critical developmental stage of kids and getting them accustomed to English words and reading?
I'm sure that you have heard of the 6 Skills by 6 Years, and it is a program that was built on the Public Library Association's 6 Every Child Ready to Read. And Johnson County Library set forth the initiative to establish this in the county and for all of those that we encounter. And then I was brought in with a team to translate it into Spanish. And one of my jobs is to hold those weekly story times, per se, where I am not only reading to the children, but showing and demonstrating to those mothers and fathers how reading is important. Because of funding that I've received, I've been able to give books to parents. They may be strictly in Spanish or Spanish and English. And then I encourage them, if they have school-aged children, they can read the English, parents can read the Spanish, we both know the story, and let's talk about it or let's interact. Those are some ways that I encourage parents.
How much help do you think that provides those families? I mean, you're meeting with them once a week, and here we are talking about reading to kids maybe 3 or 4 times a day for 10 or 15 minutes.
That's very true. And I do stay, I have close relationship with the people that I work with, and I do stay on top of it because I have all of those books that I want them to share, plus gifting them books so that they have their library. I stay up with them.
You know, my sense is that there are a lot of Kansans and maybe even a lot of people listening who don't really appreciate the challenges that folks like you are up against here. I mean, this is a whole different world that you're navigating, and you're climbing a mountain every day.
It's very true to a certain respect, but I do have passion. I believe that anyone who believes in literacy should get on board with that resource investment with passion. And if you're an English speaker and you know Spanish speaking families, send them to the library, make contact, give them books, let them know that there are resources for them in Spanish also.
How quickly do folks from Latin American countries navigate to the library? Because they, as you pointed out, they come from a culture where libraries are not prevalent. Do they gravitate to the library pretty quickly?
They do, to the respect that they know that there are free computers. We can use computers. And,
sure.
And they need to write, and they need write letters maybe to their lawyers, or maybe they're on Facebook or something. Then when they're there, if I see them or if they have any other information, the staff directs them to my area where I am, so I can find out what their needs are. Sometimes it's as simple as, where are the clinics in the area? Is there Spanish-speaking staff at such a place? And sometimes their needs are a little more intense, such as immigration lawyers or maybe
right.
counselors for their children who speak Spanish, because that's very important when it comes to those very critical parts of life.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR, and we're talking about the challenges of teaching fourth graders in Kansas and those kids younger how to read. You know, Sean, I'm wondering how the Kansas Health Foundation intersects with all of this and what kinds of help your foundation provides.
Right. Well, you know, one of the things is we just launched our Can't Wait to Read campaign to raise awareness about the importance of early literacy amongst parents and caregivers. And a component of that campaign is a website that we developed, readwiththem.org, which allows parents to sign up for text or email messages for 28 days and really gives free tips, resources, and information about other organizations that can help kids learn to read. And so it's a really easy way to incorporate literacy activities into daily life, like playing, talking, singing, reading and writing.
Right.
And so you've got just with your mobile device availability to tap into so many different resources.
Barry Zuckerman, I'm wondering what other things the state of Kansas might be considering or should be considering as it navigates this challenge of getting kids up to grade level by fourth grade.
Yeah, no, I think not just Kansas, but all over the country. I think, again, and I'm going to focus on the younger years before children either get into preschool or the school. I think that children and the families who get to libraries get something very special. The question is, how do we get more children there? So I think we have to demystify to parents what reading to children are, because what will happen, a parents will sit down with a book, and first of all, if they can't read, they're probably not going to sit down with a book. But if they can read, they'll start reading a text, and the children won't pay, the 1 and 2 and 3 year olds won't pay attention, because the process, again, is sharing a book and pointing and naming and using the book as a stimulus for engaging in words. You know, it's the exposure to words and the back and forth exchange that's important. One study has shown that children of well-educated parents versus children of low-income parents, well-educated parents by age 3 years have heard 30 million words, and those of low income have heard 10 million. That has a big impact on how many words children are exposed to and therefore, is stored in their brain. I think what we need is, besides pediatricians, and we give out books as part of a national program, Reach Out and Read. We give away about 5 million books a year, every year now for close to 30 years. But we need community strategies, and we need to create a culture of parents reading and talking and singing to their children. And it's going to take other organizations besides pediatricians and libraries. There's an effort around some places in the country where they put up, you know, little signs in stores, supermarkets, where, you know, it prompts parents to ask their children a question so they can get into a conversation. You know, we go to the milk, say, where does milk come from? And then you can mention cows. So we really need, you know, some sort of community awareness that the community is going to buy into, because I would hope to think that business will support this, because if not, they're not going to get the sort of people they need to have the skills to be responsible and effective in their work. So I think a community strategy of awareness and also demystifying what reading is to parents, and particularly for young kids, reading for kids in a group is hard because you really almost have to do it one-to-one. Hmm. So, you know, I think we need one way to do is get some videos. So once parents see what you do with children at different ages, they can model that. And with the older children, I think parents have an idea. But being illiterate doesn't matter. I've taken books to Bangladesh and to China. And once you get a picture book, you know, not text, where parents will start pointing and naming, I don't understand what they're saying, but I hear them talking and I see them smiling, and I know that's a good start.
Our phone number here, if you want to join our conversation, 816-235-2888. We're talking about reading to youngsters, how important it is. 816-235-2888, where you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. Barry, I want to come back to this point because I think it's central to what we're talking about here. If I'm hearing you right, you're saying that the style of reading is just as important as the frequency. How you approach this is really critical.
Yes, style, but it has to do with children's development. You know, you have to be where they are. So, you know, with a one-year-old, it's really looking, it's picture books with bright color common objects or animals that kids can relate to. It's not a text, but you point and you name and you talk about, you know, oh, this is an apple. Remember, you had an apple yesterday when you were hungry.
Right.
So it really becomes a stimulus for doing that. So it's not reading a text. I think when people think about reading to children, they actually think of reading the story. That's not going to hold children under three's attention. It really needs to be the back and forth. And the back and forth, the dialogic reading, has been shown in the last couple of years in a couple studies that really has an impact on the brain.
Okay.
The place in the brain where that goes, the language place, when there's more back and forth is bigger than when there's less back and forth. Huh. And it's, again, associated with children having more words.
Let's go to some phone calls here. And Sally from Lawrence. Sally, you're on Up to Date.
Yeah, I just wanted to reiterate, make that comment that brain development is also affected by screen use. And actually reading from a screen or looking at a screen changes the rapid eye movement. And it also doesn't stimulate the same parts of the brain that reading does, including development of empathy as you hear story is different than if you read it or see it on a screen.
Sean, how do you guys at the foundation approach this idea of reading on screens versus reading books, and how important that distinction is?
I think, you know, when you're reading, you know, print on a page, you know, you talk about attention span and the use of screens, and just kind of the more that you use them, the more the attention span goes down. So I think it is important to, you know, be able to sit down with a book and be able to read, you know, print versus a screen.
Yeah.
You know, that's important.
God, it's hard for adults. I find myself at night when I want to sit down and just quietly read for a while, you just got to almost yank yourself away from the tube because you're watching, you're looking at the computer, reading the New York Times or whatever, and you got to make a really deliberate effort to get away from it. You know, you find the same thing, Christine? Yeah.
It is. It's true. When you're looking at illustrations on a page and you're pointing things out to a child, they may not be focusing in on everything that you're pointing to. They may be focusing in a little bit more about that little duck on the pond.
Mm-hmm.
And with a screen, you can't do that because it's moving very fast. So there's nothing really developing in there to question. It is very important to read to a child. You're not only developing that text and vocabulary, but you're developing some types of skills like comprehension and recognizing things, because outside of that book, they may make that relationship from the apple they ate yesterday or earlier in the day to the apple that's on the page. Yeah. And then that becomes part of who they are. When you're with a screen, I really truly believe that there's a connection between those screens and that brain development side and some of the issues we see in school today.
Let's go back to some phone calls. And Patricia from South Kansas City. Patricia, you're on Up to Date.
Yes. My kids were babies back in the late 80s, and we were part of a Hickman Mills School District's Parents as First Teachers program. And we had a parent educator came and gave us tips. And so I always read to my kids pictures from, you know, day one, you know, as soon as I could hold them in my arms. And they were turned out to be excellent readers. By the time they were in kindergarten, they were reading chapter books on their own without any assistance. So,
yeah.
And they ended up in gifted programs and it's just been a wonderful, wonderful experience, and I don't know whether that program is still in place, but it was an awesome program having the parent educator come and let you know that you are the child's first teacher.
Right. Patricia, you're nodding your head. That program is still in place?
They are. Many of the school districts do have their parents as teachers development for families in their school district.
Let's go to Kim from Peculiar. Kim, good morning.
Good morning. I've always been a big reader, and before my kids were born and when they were infants, whatever I read out loud. When they were big enough to focus, we did the picture books and stuff. And the parent educators were always amazed because my kids could talk in sentences by the time they were two, and they were reading at a college level before they even hit high school.
And Kim, did you say you were reading to your kids before they were born?
Yeah, when I was pregnant, if I was reading a book, I just read out loud so they would, I was hoping they would just hear my voice. The same thing when they were infants, I would just, if I was reading anything, whether it was the TV guide or a book, I was reading it out loud to them while I was holding them.
Professor Zuckerman, is there any way for us to know if that approach in fact is effective?
Well, we certainly do know that more words that children hear, that's better. Whether you read a book, reading a book to, you know, if you will, your newborn baby is probably more comfortable for you than talking to them. So hearing the words is important. I always like to think about book sharing. So up to 6 months, hearing the words is important. But by 6 months, children have what's called joint attention. They can start looking at something that you're looking at. And that's the time to bring in books. Hmm. You know, prior to 6 months, they're not going to look at anything. They can hear you. And if you enjoy reading out loud and they're with you, I think that's fine. But so that's just hearing the words. But by 6 months, you can start hearing and looking and naming and pointing. So there's two different processes. Huh. And it's important to point out, I get worried when we tell some mothers, particularly from other cultures or low-income mothers, start reading to your newborn, because they're going to read and they're going to say, what am I doing?
Mm-hmm.
You know,
right.
He's not talking. He's not this and that. So I think the easiest first step, you know, certainly talk to your babies. Babies are certainly interested in people and faces and facial expressions.
Professor, I got a scoot here, and I just want to point out quickly, I should mention, Martha tweeted us that Reach Out and Read, the program that Dr. Zuckerman has helped found, is very active in the Kansas City Metro, serves nearly 30,000 kids between 0 to 5 ages every year, so just so everyone knows that. Professor Zuckerman from Boston University, thanks so much for your time today.
Okay, thank you.
Christine Peterson with the Johnson County Public Library, thank you.
Thank you.
And Sean Brown with the Kansas Health Foundation, appreciate your time as well.
Thank you.
Tomorrow on the show, how poor African Americans and recent immigrants helped push Pendergrast era Kansas City to become a modern beef and railroad powerhouse. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.